Yeah, you can do that after the talk. Don't you? Yes, good. What a change from 4 years ago in a tiny room in Bilberry Hill, those of us who were there. So it's great to see so many people here this weekend, and I hope you're going to enjoy it and are enjoying it and that you slept well. So when I was thinking about this talk and this topic of energy, I actually remembered an article written in the Independent newspaper by my dad. And I remembered he said it was when Neil McGregor was appointed the new director of the British Museum. And my father wrote a really lovely article giving the director of the British Museum some very friendly advice. And he said, if the ill-behaved tourist hordes, self-obsessed curators, and ill-chosen trustees get you down, go to the Tibetan collections in the British Museum. So if you've ever been to the British Museum, they've got a lovely, quite small collection of Tibetan artwork. And he said that if you go there, you'll see an 18th century figure, a Buddhist figure, in ecstatic rapture, trampling on obstructions. So if you've ever seen these figures, they're these sort of amazing, sort of strong figures, stamping on little sort of figures under their feet, little tiny weak figures. So, and he said, he made the point, he said, it's not beautiful, but rather it expresses the energy released as mind unites with body, wisdom with knowledge, passion with reason. And he said, if you see this figure, it convinces you, as it was meant to, that there are no demons that you cannot realise and trample underfoot. So I was thinking about this and I thought, well, that's quite an astute observation of my father, because what my father realised was that in Tibetan art, it's not expressing beauty that is important, but expressing energy. And it got me into thinking, well, why would it be that in Tibet it's more important to express energy than beauty? And in a way, I think that what the Tibetans are trying to say is that without energy, there is no spiritual life. And that's what they want to communicate to people. That's what they want to show people directly. It's energy that you need to practice the spiritual life. You could also put the argument you need beauty as well, but we're going to focus on energy today. So energy is one of those very tricky words to define. And if you look it up in the Oxford Dictionary, which I did, it says it means strength, vitality, physical and mental powers required for sustained activity. So it means that all your efforts, all your strength, all your vitality, all your power is directed towards a purpose. And you need that for sustained activity. And you need it because I suppose without energy, without motivation and will, without strength and vitality, you can have all the best ideas, you can have all the best teachers, you can have all the best meditation techniques, but you won't put any of them into practice. So in some ways it's not necessarily that popular idea, but hopefully it's popular among young people. But it's sometimes even necessary to see the spiritual life as a battle, in which all your strength, all your power, all your vitality is engaged. Because if you don't see it as something that really takes on your energy, you just won't do it. One of the greatest Buddhists of the 20th century, Dr. Ambedkar, talks a lot about this, bringing this quality into the spiritual life. And he says that liberty is never received as a gift. It has to be fought for. And he says, if you want to achieve liberation, you have to go through the ordeal of fire. He says, greatness can be achieved only by struggle and sacrifice. Mm. And if you look at the life of someone like Dr. Ambedkar, you really see how much struggle and how much sacrifice he gave to the spiritual life in order to overcome obstacles and achieve greatness. And he did achieve greatness, not just for himself, but for many others. So that's why the Tibetans chose to represent the spiritual life as energy, not necessarily just beauty as other Buddhist artists did. So the question arises for each and every one of us, how can we awaken energy? When our energy is awakened, how can we channel it towards the spiritual life? So I'll answer the first point first, how to awaken energy. And the founder of our order, Sangharakshita, makes the link between energy and emotions. He says to engage energy is to engage the emotions. And he says that actually all of us have plenty of energy. In fact, all of us are energy. That's what human beings are. They're a manifestation of energy. But the problem comes in our lives when energy is unengaged, when we don't have a single purpose to direct it to, when energy is undirected or dissipated or blocked. So we've all got energy, but we don't quite put it into something. It kind of sways this way and that. So, it becomes a bit scattered. There's a bit here and a bit there. And so you might find, you know, sometimes your emotions are moving in one direction. You know, sometimes you get really into your studies or really into your work. And then you sort of, it drifts the other way, and then you get really into parties and, I don't know, whatever you get up to at parties. And then you think, no, what is, I've got to really concentrate on my spiritual life, I'm going to go on retreat, I'm just going to drop everything else, I'm just going to go on retreat, and I'm just going to go to the Buddhist centre, I'm going to meditate all the time, I'm going to meditate every morning, and then that lasts about a week, and then you go on to a different day, and oh, what I really want to do is, you know, etc, etc. So if we want to awaken energy, the first thing we've got to do is find something that we really care about, that we can really pour all of our energies into, that we can really give ourselves to, that we can direct all that energy into one place. And when I was thinking about this, well, what is the emotion that we need to cultivate? Because, yes, we need to engage our emotions in the spiritual life, but what emotion? And when I thought about this, I thought about the emotion of longing. So in Buddhism, this is either called chanda, which means eagerness, or more poetically, it's trishna, or thirst. So here you have an image of someone being in a desert, desperate for water, longing for water. There's a real urgency to what they're doing. And you can imagine, if you're in a desert and you really, really need water, you're going to pour all your energies into finding water. You're not going to just sit there and think, you know, I watched a really great DVD. What was it called? And, you know, actually, maybe I'll just go that way and just go to the party over there. You know, actually, I quite fancy reading that book. You know, you're not going to be like that. You're going to be completely focused on getting water. And in a way, that needs to be the feel of our spiritual life. That urgency. Even one could say a desperation. It's a kind of feeling that, and we've all got it to an extent, it's sort of, you've got this emptiness that longs for fulfillment, that longs for completion. And of course, what we do in our lives, we have this inner emptiness, we long for fulfillment and completion, but we look for it in many different objects, most of which don't work. So what I've been looking at recently in my own practice is taking it away, that sense of longing, away from the object and looking at that sense of longing itself before it directs itself into an object. And what I've noticed is that at root in my being is a desire to transcend my present experience. So there's this longing, there's a kind of basic longing to transcend my current experience, to have something more. And what then happens is I look for it in objects that don't work. So I have this sort of sense of longing. And then I just think, I've just got to distract myself or, you know, what I really want to do. Actually, I live at Tirak Loka, which is a retreat centre in the middle of the countryside. So there's not that much opportunity for anything else than spiritual practice. But if there is an opportunity, I will find it. So we've got quite a lot of DVDs. So that's where a lot of my attention can go to. When I'm sort of nameless longing, and then I just think, okay, I'll just watch TV. But actually going back to the longing itself, without it finding an object, I sort of realised that that has been a characteristic of my whole life. There's always been a longing in me to make my life more meaningful, particularly, I think, for me from about the age of 10. And in some ways, that gave me a lot of energy in my life. But it was energy without direction. It was energy without purpose. It was almost quite painfully felt. I knew I was looking for something, but I didn't know what I was looking for. And all the objects that were presented to me in my life somehow didn't seem enough. You know, you just don't worry about those kind of things. Just, you know, get a good career and a boyfriend and have a family and travel a lot. And all those answers for this sort of nameless longing just didn't seem enough. You know, there's nothing wrong with those things, but they didn't seem to me a complete and fulfilled life. What I had was a thirst for something much higher, a longing for what is possible far beyond the small confines of the life that was usually presented to me. I had a longing for breaking through this ordinary consciousness. You know, here was my state of mind, here was my world, and I just knew there had to be something more than that. I knew that that wasn't going to do it for me, that wasn't going to fulfill my longing. And a series of slightly arbitrary events led me to the South London Buddhist Centre. And there, even on the first class, I had a vision of what I could be. And that vision of what I could be was the Buddha. I didn't really understand what a Buddha meant or enlightenment meant or anything like that. And I thought, you know, Buddhists were a bit odd. And I went and talked to the man in the suit, because I reckoned if he had a suit, he was normal. Wasn't a white person pretending to be Indian. So I just went and talked to the man in the suit. But anyway, on that slightly strange first class, I had a vision of a vision presented to me. This is a person who is fulfilled. This is a human being who's done something extraordinary, even more than human with their life. And what was more than that for me, what was even more significant in some ways than that, was that we were taught the Metta-Bhava meditation. And at that moment I realised not only did I have a vision of who I could become, I also had the tools to make that possible, to bring that into effect in my life. And that moment, at that Buddhist centre, I just remember sitting in my meditation thinking, I found it. I can't believe it, I found it. I'm not there yet, but at least I know what journey I'm on. I think what really overwhelmed me was, yes, there was a worthy object to that longing. Here was this longing, and here was a worthy object that I could pour that longing into. All that energy had a purpose. And I think reading the Buddhist scriptures, this reflects partially, in a small way, something of the experience of the Buddha. Because you get the impression from the early Buddhist texts that the Buddha really reflected, before he was enlightened, he really reflected on his life. He reflected on the inevitability of sickness, illness, and it said that the vanity of health left him. He reflected on the fact that all of us are going to get old, even all of us. And this young people event is led by so kindly reminded us, we'll all get old. And it said that when he reflected on this, the vanity of youth entirely left him. And when he reflected on the fact that, okay, well, maybe not all of us are going to reach old age, but we certainly will die, when he reflected on death, the vanity of life left him. And it said that he reflected on conflict. He reflected on how beings struggle and fight, how people can just be after what they can get. And they just push each other out the way in that process. He said it's like fish struggling in water, fast drying out. Get this image of this very small, muddy pond. And these fish just pushing each other out the way just to be able to breathe. And it said that when he saw people behaving in this way, he was frightened. He was genuinely afraid. And he longed to find a place of shelter, but he could not find it. And it said in the scriptures how he reflected that in some ways we're all searching. But he saw that some searches are more fruitful than others. Some searches lead to going round and round the same old endless cycles. He said he saw that impermanent beings search for permanence in things that never remain the same. And suffering people search for happiness in things that cannot possibly bring them happiness. And he saw how we go on this kind of unconscious searching that's never fulfilled. You just go to the same familiar things again and again and again. You find the same problems again and again and again. In a way, I was talking, only been talking about the unsatisfactoriness of sexual relationships last night. And I said to Kennedy, I said, well, really it's the triumph of hope over experience. Maybe that's just me. But in the same sense, I thought, well, actually it's a bit more broad than that particular issue. I thought, well, anyway, that sort of characterises life, doesn't it? You know, you try and hope. You know, when has a DVD ever really worked? You know, when has it ever really worked going to a party? Maybe again, maybe I'm just saying much more about myself here. But sometimes if you just look at the reality of your searching and what you go for refuge to, you see, well, what if I actually just reflected on the reality of the situation? I'd do something completely different. But we don't, do we? We think, well, you know, maybe the next one, maybe the next time it will really work. That'll be the one. That'll be the chocolate cake. So yeah, he saw the ignoble quest. The ignoble quest being a quest that just goes around the same old familiar habits again and again and again and never really works. But he also saw the noble quest. He saw there is a search. In a way, it's not the searching that's bad. It's what you're searching towards, what you're looking for that's going to actually fulfill that search. And he said there is such a thing as the noble quest. You can search for something that really works. You can search for supreme liberation from all bondage. And I think in this context, he means the liberation from the bondage of the ignoble search. Of the search that takes you again and again around the same old cycles. And yeah, it's interesting, the image he uses here, he talks about yoga kama, which is, that means a kind of peacefulness from an endless toil. I think that's how he saw, in a way, life as it's ordinarily lived. The ignoble search, in a way, feels like endless toil. So the image here is of, it comes from a root which means a yolk. Now, for years and years and years, I thought that was an egg yolk. But it's not an egg yolk. It's this thing that, if you... it sort of splat. Or I can't get that image, but someone did throw an egg at me on the street. It wasn't very pleasant, so... I don't think that's what he was talking about. I was actually talking about, if you go to India, you see these great, I'll give you an image for it, which might help. So in India, what you get is you get these great old oxen who do a lot of work, and they wear these great wooden collars round their neck, and they have to pull these great ploughs. And if you see them, you know, in the midday sun, so the yoke is that wooden thing round their necks, not an egg. And it's like, you can just see them in the midday sun just trying to twirl, and they're sweating and sweating. And the thing is, they look so dull. Their eyes just look, you know, so devoid of life. And in a way, that's what he was comparing the ignoble quest too. He was saying, well, that's what it's like. It's like being one of those oxen. It just never ends, you know, and it's dull. It's a state of lack of energy, of just endless dragging along this cart. And he said, but the noble quest is the supreme liberation from that kind of bondage. It's the liberation from that kind of toil. It's the search for enlightenment itself. And he said that he saw the reason that people fight and struggle and push each other out the way is because their heart is pierced by a thorn. And he saw that the thorn can be taken out. And he says, "So at a later time, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the first stage of life, and while my parents, unwilling, were crying with tears streaming down their faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness." So from then on, his search was the noble search. It was the search for liberation, for truth, for understanding. And you get the impression with the Buddha, every moment was spent in that search. All his strength, all his vitality was directed towards the purpose of liberation. And that is the real awakening of energy. All that longing, all that desire poured into a worthy object. All the strength, all the vitality on a search for truth, on the search for the noble quest. And the noble quest, it really is the awakening of energy into something you can really give your life to. But he also realised that going out, setting out on the noble quest wasn't enough. The energy was awakened, but it had to be directed and trained. And in a way, the noble quest had to really take effect. It's not enough to just set out on a quest. You've also got to keep to the right path. So he used another image here. He said it's a bit like irrigators. Irrigators control the waters to feed the crops. He said it's like fletchers, arrow makers, straighten arrows. So these are all traditional Indian imagery. I've actually never seen anyone make an arrow, but I'm sure they straighten something. He says carpenters shape wood. And he says the wise control their minds. So there's an image here of discipline. That actually you have to set out on the noble quest, but you also have to discipline yourself. You have to control your own mind. And he also made the point that the energy has to be kept alive. In a way, you have to keep going with your noble quest, even when you're in the cold and dark and rain and nothing seems to be working. Because we all have those moments in our spiritual life. And there's a lovely story, actually, from some of the oldest parts of the Buddhist tradition, where he says he's just sitting there just before he gets enlightened, and he sort of has this voice, and this voice in his mind is personified as a demon called Mara. And Mara sits down next to him and says, "Wow, it's all quite hard work, isn't it? It's all quite strenuous, and really, what's the point? You know, you're a good man, you just live a good life. Don't worry with all this striving and meditation and all that sort of thing. You know, just make a few offerings to the gods and live a good human life, and you'll be reborn as something really positive. You know, just relax, don't worry about it." And the Buddha turns around and says to him, "Hello, friend of negligence." So negligence means a sort of lethargy, tiredness, where you just can't quite be bothered to do anything. And he says, "I see you, Mara, seated on your war elephant with all your troops of negligence and lethargy around you. And he says, I would rather die in this conflict than be alive but defeated. Whatever you say to me, I'm going to carry on going. I'm going to keep going with this struggle. Even though the whole world, inclusive of its gods, cannot beat that army of yours, I am going to destroy it with the power of wisdom like an unfired clay pot with a stone." So it's interesting in a way, that little story, because it shows that even the Buddha had moments where he couldn't be bothered. You know, that he had the voice going, "Oh, you know, it's just such hard work, isn't it? And it's so much easier to sort of just relax and not bother about it." But actually, to enter onto the noble quest, to maintain that energy, requires work. Actually, interestingly, in English, and I believe in French as well, but I'm not sure about German, the word energy comes from the Greek, which means work within. So if you want to look what energy actually means in your life, energy means work. And in some ways, I think this answers a real concern that people have about the topic of energy. Because when you start talking about the spiritual life as a battle, or awakening energy for the spiritual life, people have a very real concern, and a very, a rational concern, which is the concern of burnout. So they worry that you're going to just, push yourself too hard. You're going to be really idealistic, and sometimes you can see this in the spiritual life. People are very idealistic, and they think, I'm just going to do all the, I'm on the noble quest. I'm not going to do anything else. I'm going to do all these wonderful things. I'm going to meditate and blah, blah, blah. And then you just see them hit a wall, and then, and then it's like they hate the spiritual life. And all they want to do is take drugs and go out to parties. So that is a real concern, isn't it? You're going to stick totally over-idealistic and forget that, there's part of you that does just want to relax or go out to parties or whatever. And there is a fear that you're going to exhaust yourself in youthful idealism. That's the image, isn't it? There's a sort of the youthful revolutionary who just hits middle age and just thinks, God, that's, completely unrealistic. So how am I going to answer that question? I suppose one way of answering that concern, and there are a few, I'm quite into youthful idealism. I haven't lost mine yet. But actually, if you think about energy, it's a discipline. And energy doesn't mean just compulsive activity for the sake of it. So it's not just running around like a headless chicken, which is an English expression. Might need to be translated. It doesn't mean you're sort of zipping around, this and that, and you never sit still. The noble quest and the real use of energy is conscious and trained and regular. In fact, in the Buddhist tradition, compulsive busyness, where you can't sit still with yourself, where you can't be with yourself, and you just use all your energy for endless activity, that's laziness. To actually use your energy for the noble quest is a discipline, and it requires a path of regular steps, regularity, and it requires being conscious about what you need to do. So that's something we could talk about in our groups. What are the dangers in awakening and using energy, and how could they be prevented? But what I want to look at in the rest of this talk is these two questions also of how to channel energy and how to keep energy alive. So when I was thinking about how can we train ourselves, how can we train our minds, how can we channel and discipline our energy, I thought of a sort of small and slightly unexplained teaching of Sangharakshita. So I've only recently found where this came from, so I'm quite proud of this. And it's all thanks to living with someone who was ordained the year I was born. So I asked you, Devi, where does the tantric precepts, because that's what we're going to look at, the tantric precepts, where do they come from? And she said, they're in that booklet, Sayings, Poems, Reflections. No. She said, the one, it was produced in 1976. No, I don't. So this was new to me. But apparently, in 1976, Sangharakshita, and actually I've got it with me, he produced this little booklet of sayings, poems, reflections. And it's interesting seeing this because when you talk to more senior order members about 1976, you kind of get the impression that what Sangharakshita had is he had a sangha full of young people. They were young and they had a lot of energy, but it was sometimes undirected, and I'm just going to fall back on Sri Devi here, and Sri Devi says it's sometimes a bit blocked as well. And so I was thinking about this. I was thinking, well, why did Bhante want to give Bhante Sangharakshita give this teaching in 1976? Well, maybe he was responding to the needs of the time. He was responding to the needs of the young people in the movement at that time. And it's something very practical that people can practice. So it's the five tantric energy precepts that are loosely based on the five ethical precepts which we chanted this morning, and that most of us are familiar with. So I'll just go through them. And if you want a copy of them, we've got them on little bits of paper in the reception. So the first tantric precept is do not obstruct the energy of another person. So in a way, the first energy or tantric precept is seeing that other people are on a quest just as we are on a quest. Other people have a thirst for a fulfilled life. They have a longing for what is possible. So don't get in their way. Don't obstruct them. So one thing you might want to talk about in your groups is how we obstruct another's energy. And there's lots of different ways we do this. I think one of them is putting pressure on them to do what you want them to do. Some of it, and that kind of translates into giving people premature advice, giving advice too quickly when you don't know the person that well, and when you don't really know what they need. In fact, in some ways, we don't even know what's best for us. So why we'd know what's best for other people is a bit of a mystery. But that's what we do. We like to kind of tell people what to do. We like to give them advice. Sometimes that advice works, but sometimes it doesn't. So sometimes it's best to just let them be. Let them go on their own quest. And sometimes we block the energy of others also by dismissing their hopes and dreams and plans. So they come and tell you, and they think, oh, I've had this really great idea, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And you start going, no, it'll never happen. You know, it's just never going. We tried that in 1998. We tried that, and it didn't work. And it's not going to work for you. And really, can you take it on? Not sure, you know. So it's a bit like you can see they're all really bright and enthusiastic, and then they suddenly start looking really down, and they leave you thinking, oh, right, okay, well, back to the drawing board then. So I think what happens is we can exaggerate. I can exaggerate difficulties. I'm a kind of problem orientated person, so I look straight for the problem. And actually, that really it blocks the energy of others, because it means there they are with all their hopes and dreams and plans, and I've just gone, you know, put a wall in front of them. So sometimes it's good to let people, even if you think it's a bit of a mistake, does it matter? Does it matter if they make a mistake? Maybe they're going to learn by that mistake, and maybe you're wrong. Speaking personally, I'm never wrong. Perhaps it might be a possibility one day. And I think also what we could reflect is when we're about to leap in with the advice, who's this really about? Who's this advice about? Is it about them or is it actually about you? So stand clear. Unless it's going to really be a disaster, unless they're actually going to die or be injured as a result, just stand back. Let people make their own mistakes and find their own path. Get out of their way. Even sometimes let them have the limelight. Let them do some crazy plan and let them make it happen. In connection with this, I heard a talk once by Lochner, an audience member, and she was talking about the possibility of blue sky communication. And I really like this image, actually, that sometimes we can go into communication with someone and we've got all sorts of ideas about what's going to happen. So we go in and we've got a whole agenda about where this conversation is going to go and what they're going to do as a result of it. So in a way, when you go in like that with a whole heap of agendas and ways to, you know, this is what this person needs to hear sort of thing, you block communication. And a better image in a way for communication is just to have an openness. A blue sky. See what happens. Don't just block someone immediately, but just see where the communication might go. Keep it free flowing. And even when someone is really difficult, obstructive, even unskillful, if we keep this attitude of a blue sky communication, we've always got the lines of communication open with them. So it's keeping that openness, not just blocking someone, but keeping an openness, keeping a dialogue. And I suppose the positive formulation of this first tantric precept is to encourage others to grow in their own way. The Dharma is sometimes compared to a rain cloud. The Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, in a way it flows on each of us. But we all respond to it in our own way. We all grow in our own way. So I suppose the first energy precept is just letting people grow in their own way. We're not all going to be the same. We're not going to be all images of each other. Actually, people are very different, and they grow in their own way. I remember someone saying to me once, he said, 99% encouragement, 1% criticism. And in a way, we need to keep that in mind. Just encourage people to grow in their own way. So the second precept is not to drain the energy of others and give freely of your own energy. So thinking about how we drain the energy of others, I think most of it is by negativity and expressing negative emotions through speech. So one of the things that I think particularly the English are very good at is grumbling. So, you know, we get to a place like this, and actually it's great. We've got this huge place. We're being fed delicious food. We've all got a bed, I hope. And, you know, it's straight into the kind of, well, you know, there aren't enough cups, or, you know, it's like the bed, the springs on the mattresses are really horrible, and there aren't enough showers. And, you know, it's all that kind of constant grumbling. And if you're around someone who does that a lot, actually, English people grumble about the weather mostly. So you just go, it's always raining, you know, we never have a summer. It's just, you know, it's the grey skies every day. And in other countries, they have blue skies, and it's all so much better. Blah, 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 blah. And if you're standing with someone who's doing that endless grumbling, you just feel completely drained by the end of it. Another one, as I said before, is criticising. Sometimes it's useful to go through difficulties that might arise, but a kind of constant habitual criticising just drains people's energy. Actually, Sangha actually talks in one context about emotional vampires, that's the other one. So we drain other people's energy by constantly talking about our own problems without wanting to find a solution. So it's not bad to talk about your problems with a friend, but you've also got to be receptive to what they might say back, or to what their needs might be, that actually maybe they're not quite in the mood for you just talking about your problems all the time. And you can tell when you're in that situation with someone who's just, you know, talking about their problems, and you might suggest that they might take a course of action without giving them inappropriate advice, then they kind of look at you in shock. You know, they don't actually want to solve it. They just want to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. In this connection, I remember when I split up from a boyfriend, and an order member, I was moaning about it to an order member, and he said, look, I'm so sick of you moaning about this. I'm going to give you 10 minutes. And in that 10 minutes, you can slag him off as much as you like. You can say how awful he is, how much you hate him, how much you never want to speak to him again. But after that 10 minutes, I never want to hear another which was really good, so I got my watch up. So it's actually, I only lasted for two. It was so horrible, even I couldn't take it. So yes, don't drain the energy of others. Give freely of your own energy. So this is partly being aware of other people and responding. You know, aware of what their needs might be, and actually being looking for an opportunity to be generous, to give them what they might need. And this is a bigger topic, but I'll say briefly that, in a way, you could look at money as a form of energy. It's sort of energy locked up. So another way to give freely of your own energy is to give a nice, you know, donation for this weekend. But give freely of your own energy, looking for an opportunity to be generous. To give of your own energy. You know, to listen to someone. I think listening is a really good way of giving freely of your own energy. Okay. So the third one is to not misuse energy. So the Noble Quest is a demanding quest, and it requires us not to waste our energy in fruitless pursuits that lead nowhere. And sometimes we do this. We have this energy, but we use it for ends that are at best meaningless and at worst destructive. So it's up to you to decide what is a misuse of energy and what isn't. One thing I do, I think is very important to say, is that we don't want to become so focused on our noble quest that we block ourselves and end up not doing anything unless it's spiritual. You know, so you just sit there. Well, I can only meditate. And I'm not allowed to talk in frivolous speech. I can only talk about the Buddha's teaching. So we don't want to end up like that. We don't want to end up totally alienated. I'd rather people just ran around and had play fights with teaspoons or something than end up I'm being mindful. So, yeah, it doesn't mean you can't have fun. We need pleasure. We need pleasure. We need a bit of silliness. We need to express our energy. Mm. But we need to do that in such a way that our consciousness is lifted and not just not that our energy is just poured into the ground. We need to find things that conduce to energy, express energy, which lead us feeling happy and bright and positive. Not using our energy to things that just bring us down. We need to use our energy in a way that moves us closer to enlightenment. So it might be at that moment what you need to do is have a play fight with some teaspoons, and that might lead you closer to enlightenment. But it's always being aware. It's always being aware and using energy wisely. Asking yourself the question, what actually raises my level of consciousness? What activity really gives me more energy, not less? And being realistic about this. So Bhante Sangharakshita talks about the arts as a way to kind of have pleasure but also lift your level of consciousness. But I think we can use other things, like being out in nature, going for a walk. I think for me a wise use of energy is actually communication. I find myself lifted and engaged and positive when I can talk to people on a real level about things that are important to me. I also find a wise use of energy that really lifts my level of consciousness is work. I really enjoy working. That's what I love about this Buddhafield team, actually. And it's a real characteristic of Buddhafield is that they really use work as a spiritual practice. And what I notice about that is when I'm around a team that's using work as a spiritual practice, I feel really happy. I just feel really energetic and engaged, even though I'm not actually helping them a lot. So there are lots of things that are wise use of energy that give us more energy and that lift our level of consciousness. Dance, art, I don't know, whatever it is. So the fourth one is using for any given purpose the energy appropriate to that purpose, not one which is inappropriate. It's quite a long-winded one, this one. So it's about using energy appropriately. Seeing what the situation demands and doing what is needed at that moment. So there are a couple of examples of this. I know I've definitely been guilty of this one, which is that everyone's sitting around really calmly. Maybe they've just come out of meditation and they're all, you know, quite deep into something. Maybe they're even sitting in silence. And you come in like a little puppy dog. And you can just see everyone looking a bit, you know, oh God, what is she doing? That's been me. In a way, so that's not an appropriate use of energy. It's not seeing what the energy demands. At that moment, the energy does not demand you to be like a little dog. That's not the dog moment. So, yeah, one thing actually to say as well in this connection is that energy doesn't necessarily mean excitement. I think when people talk about energy, they think it means you've got to be running around with this big grin on your face all the time. Well, energy doesn't have to be like that. Energy can be very calm and focused, very directed. It doesn't mean you have to jump up around like Tigger. But you can also do it the other way around. So Alice and I were just talking about working in the evolution shop. And you can have this thing where you're working really silently in a stock room. And, you know, you've been very mindful, you're pricing up the stock. You're in quite a smooth, quite a gentle state. Maybe you haven't talked to anyone for a while. And then you come out on the shop floor in the middle of Christmas. And it's like the shop is completely full of people. And all your friends are trying to serve everyone and they're running around. That is not the moment to start trying to be, like, really calm. sorry, you know, I know you want that wind chime, but I just need to be in my body. That's just not the moment to do that. You can be mindful and move quickly. It's possible to do that. Ninjas do that. We're going to the ninja phase, not the slug phase. So yes, it's also possible to have energy and mindfulness. So yes, so there's times to express high energy, there's times to express a little more focused energy. And context is everything. That's just a general rule for life. Context is everything. I was talking to Vidanya, actually, an order member in Sheffield, about fundraising, and he said that one of the things they're taught is that to try and match the energy of the person that you're talking to. So when you go and open a door, I haven't done fundraising, but there's plenty of opportunities in this movement to do some fundraising. It's a very beneficial spiritual practice. So when you go to this door, so that you've got a complete stranger behind this door, and they open the door, and maybe they're quite calm and subdued. Well, if you're high energy, they're going to find that really difficult. But if they're really high energy and you're really low energy, they're also going to find that difficult. So it's trying to respond to the energy of others, try and match people's energy, and then communication is possible. It's interesting that Sangharaksha defines, it says the Sangha, the spiritual community, is characterized by vital mutual responsiveness. And in a way we could say that's the same with energy. Energy is a responsiveness. It's a responsiveness to the energy of others. It's not just hitting people over the head with your energy or whatever, sliding under them. So yeah, we've got to respond to the energy of others. Be appropriate. Look what state you're in and what you need, and look what state other people are in and what they need, and respond. So the last one is to not allow energy to become turbid, but to keep it clear and bright. And actually, I think this is one of the characteristics of Buddhist practice, is that people become very clear and bright in their energy. That's a very good, fruitful sign of Buddhist practice. And there's the obvious expressions of turbid energy as well. So, you know, we can all think in our groups about what dulls our energy, what keeps our energy turbid. How do we explain the word turbid? It's a sort of sinking, grey, sloppy, soupy kind of energy. And it's up to us to reflect on what gives us that kind of energy. So I just thought of a few examples. Smoking too much of anything makes your energy turbid. It makes it kind of grey and soupy and dull. Drinking alcohol makes your energy dull. Watching too much TV or being on the internet too much, you know, completely alienates you from your energy, and you find your energy just sinking down. Sitting around too much, this is what I found touching Tiratanamoka, you can just sit around all day. And if I sit around all day, my energy starts sliding down. So it's up to us to keep our energy clear and bright. And again, it takes awareness to notice. To notice when your energy is starting to become dull and to do something about it. So, you know, maybe you need to go for a rest. Maybe you need to go and have a run. Maybe you need to go for a walk or speak to a friend. But however you find your energy is lifted. I've actually found my little way now in Tiratanamoka, which I'll share with you. Quite a personal reflection with 130 people, which is when I'm finding my energy just slipping down, I don't have a lot of time, I go and put on my massive pink headphones and listen to my iPod and then dance around my room. And hopefully, I thought no one could see me, you know, so that's why I decided to stay dancing. And then I realised one of the study rooms looked straight into my bedroom. So I could see this little study group going on and everyone looking really serious. As you could see the back of Alice's head. And there was me in my big pink headphones. But yes. But you know, if it keeps your energy clear and bright and makes you happy, that's good. So yeah, it's always being responsive of what you need to do to just lift your energy a little bit. So that's a few ways, those five tantric precepts are a few ways to channel your energy, but you also need to keep it alive, which is a kind of a similar point, really. And keeping our energy clear and bright involves keeping our inspiration alive, keeping the noble quest alive and present in our experience. And I've just got two ways to suggest that we might do this, but this is something we could talk about in our groups. How do we keep our inspiration alive? How do we keep going in the noble quest when it's cold and raining and dark? And I suppose my own experience, I suggest two ways. One of the ways is to communicate your inspiration, to talk about it with your friends, and the other one is to act on it. So, you know, the noble quest is to be shared and it's to be lived. It's not just to be kept as a nice idea. It's no use having just a feeling. You've got to act on it. It's a bit like a flame. Inspiration is like a flame. And if you just keep it in a cold and dark cupboard, it's either going to go out or it'll just burn the whole house down. But if you bring out that flame and if you share it with others, it will spark others off. So there's a very beautiful image in Buddhism, which is that just like a lamp can light many other lights, or a candle can light many other candles without itself being extinguished, so we can all light each other without ourselves diminishing. This is from the Vimalakirti Nadesha, and he says, a single bodhisattva, or someone training in the spiritual life, may establish many hundreds of thousands of living beings in enlightenment without her own inspiration being diminished. In fact, not only does it not diminish, it grows stronger. And he says, the more you teach and demonstrate skillful qualities to others, the more you grow in respect to those skillful qualities. So that's what we need to do with our inspiration. We need to light each other. We need to spark each other off. We need to demonstrate and communicate our own inspiration. So just to finish off, I'm going to just go back to the Buddha. So the Buddha goes on his noble quest. And he fights off the demon of negligence. And eventually he breaks through into enlightenment. And it's said that he sits underneath maybe one tree, maybe many trees, for a long time. He doesn't just have a nice idea and get up and go and make a cup of tea. He sits there for a long time. And it's said he sits there for a long time with his enlightenment experience radiating out in all directions. Mm. So the Buddha, the eye of the Buddha opens and he looks out around him. And he sees universes coming in and out of existence. He sees individual lives and how each person lives out their life. And it's said that as he sat there, it was a tremendous experience. All that energy, all that noble search was just pouring into this enlightenment experience. And Sangharakshita said it was like a waterfall falling from a great height. He's just completely absorbed in this experience for weeks on end, just sitting there, all this energy released, all this energy directed. And it's said that he was spiritually on fire. He was sitting there spiritually on fire, deep in meditation, completely absorbed in higher states of consciousness, like the sun in the middle of the sky radiating out in all directions. There's an image of no clouds, no obstructions, just the sun blazing and radiating in a clear blue sky. And that's the image of enlightenment. That's the characteristic, in a way, of enlightenment. Energy is the characteristic of enlightenment. Sangharakshita says we could say that the state of enlightenment is one of tremendous energy, absolute spontaneity, continually bubbling forth, a state of uninterrupted creativity. So that's enlightenment. Energy just ongoingly bubbling forth, uninterrupted creativity in all directions. Wherever the Buddha looked, wherever the Buddha placed his attention, there was energy. There was said to be looked at by the Buddha was like being looked at by an elephant, because it was this great being who paid his total attention to you, all this energy onto you. And apparently it was quite a transformative experience, someone giving you their whole attention. And that energy just blazed forth the whole of his life, right up until he died. So sometimes we think of the spiritual life as a life of calm, as a kind of, you know, there's an image of a gentle, shaven-headed monk walking very mindfully in silence, looking at the floor. And that is one image for the spiritual life, which might attract us or it might not. But the spiritual life can also be seen in terms of energy. The spiritual life can be seen in terms of the noble quest. It can be even seen in terms of battle. And I think it's the energy of the spiritual life in this context is kind of drawn forth from that great joy and enthusiasm when we see that our longing can be fulfilled. That when we see that we really can break through our ordinary states of consciousness, break through our current experience into something much, much bigger. It's the great joy that arises when you see that there is something worth searching for, that there is an answer to all of this, that human existence can be fulfilled into something even more than you can currently imagine. But out of this great joy, we also have to have the discipline, shiksha, where that joy and enthusiasm is channeled and kept alive, even throughout difficulties, even when we're finding that we can't see it working immediately. So that's what I want to leave us with on this weekend, is that image of energy and engaging our energy. Because the spiritual life is a discipline, but what a discipline. Thank you.